Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's economics correspondent, standing in for Colm O'Mungone. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
This week, the Tory leadership contest is in full swing, with more and more candidates putting themselves forward, promising to unite the country and deliver Brexit. Simples, as Theresa May once said.
We'll hear from RTE's London correspondent Fiona Mitchell on how the race is shaping up and why Boris Johnson's run into a little legal difficulty.
And why the contest is now settling into a straightforward face-off between the no-dealers and the no-no-dealers, I'll be assessing how things are being seen from Brussels.
We'll crunch the numbers on the European election results. Was there a populist surge? What role did Brexit play? And what will the new European cycle mean for the next Tory Prime Minister and that looming hard Brexit deadline of October 31st?
And talking of populism, we'll have an interview with Steve Bannon's man in Europe, where we discuss Trump, Farage, how the new nationalism is going global, and why a no-deal Brexit will be a breeze for the island of Ireland.
But let's start off with some trade news, because somebody got a big job this week, didn't they, Tony?
That's right, Sean. We heard first from Michel Barnier, the chief Brexit negotiator. He tweeted his congratulations to Sabine Vaillant, who, of course, was his deputy negotiator in the Brexit talks. And she is going to be the new director general of the trade division of the European Commission, which sends out two signals. First of all, the sense that Brexit the Brexit negotiations at least have been and gone, that ship has sailed. So they are kind of signalling that they're dismantling Task Force 50, but also that she will be in the hot seat if and when there is an EU-UK trade negotiation. Now, this is very significant because she has been seen as the really gritty, formidable negotiator that had a mastery of facts and technical points, as well as a very solid resonant grasp of the politics of Brexit, in particular the politics of the Irish border during the Brexit negotiators. I mean, the negotiations, she was seen as a very important foil for some of the more outlandish claims or aspirations, if you like, of the British negotiating team. So the fact that she now is going to be in the hot seat in any future EU-UK trade negotiations would send a bit of a frisson, I think, through Whitehall if and when those negotiations actually start. She's been in the European Commission for about 25 years. She's German. She is thought to be someone favoured by Angela Merkel. That was why she got the nod for the job as Michel Barnier's deputy. She famously did not get on with Geoffrey Cox QC, the British Attorney General, when he came over to try and give the negotiations a bit of a lift in the earlier part of this year. Apparently he called her my dear during one or two exchanges when he was trying out various propositions to the EU side, and that did not go down well at all. But ultimately she is remembered and admired, I think, for her grasp of single market regulations and also all the politics around borders and sanitary and phytosanitary checks, customs checks, all of those things, and you know, all of the differentials that would emerge between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in the event of Brexit happening if there wasn't a backstop. So that's a signal again that she is going to be very much a present and dangerous opponent for the UK if and when those trade negotiations start.
Indeed, all augurs well for the easiest trade deal ever, Tony. Can we turn to you, Fiona, because obviously the Brexit saga continues. Last Friday we saw Theresa May's lachrymose departure from number 10, but then on Tuesday there she was back in the European Council carrying on as if nothing had happened at all. So what is happening? Bring us up to date on the good old Tory party leadership race, which, as we have talked on previously on this show, has been going on for months and months and months, and will probably go on a little bit longer.
Yes, this was probably one of the more pleasurable trips to Brussels for Theresa May this week, Sean, because ultimately she knows the buck no longer stops with her. All eyes have now turned to that leadership race. She's now really just counting down the days, essentially, until Friday, the 7th of June, when she officially steps down. So she's at a point now where she doesn't get peppered with those questions about Brexit anymore in press conferences and as she's walking in and out to a variety of meetings, because ultimately that is going to be somebody else's problem, and that problem is figuring largely, centre stage absolutely in this Tory leadership race. A big field so far, 11 at the last count, but that goes up on a very, very regular basis. So from the point of view of the official deadline of the 10th of June, there's speculation that you could have maybe as many as 17 or 18 names in at that point before the knockout stages begin. All of them really essentially, though, at this point being divided into, where do you stand on the idea of a no-deal Brexit? Is it something that you support, perhaps maybe even actively support, or is it something that you feel is best avoided? Now, that is the discussion that is breaking down. I should point out that that discussion that is breaking down in the Tory leadership race is in many cases really completely overlooking all the signals that have been coming from Brussels. And when I say signals, I mean just straightforward statements from Brussels, which is this is not a deal which will be renegotiated, because those who talk about the possibility of a no-deal Brexit almost all believe that what they essentially have to do is renegotiate the deal that has already been negotiated. And that is their starting point.
Indeed,
not something that Brussels seems to be in agreement with.
Not at all. As Tony has just pointed out, the chief negotiator, the de facto negotiator, the person who does all the actual negotiating, has just been promoted to another job dealing with countries that want to have trade deals with the European Union, whoever they might be. And secondly, was this not written down in paper in the agreement, effectively a legal document from the European Council when they decided to extend the deadline for Article 50 and said in writing, this period will not be used for any kind of a renegotiation? So much for these people who claim to be lawyers and details people spotting that one.
It most certainly was written down, and it most certainly has been said time and time again. But I think it's an indication of the way that you have the same circular argument going on in Westminster, which ultimately comes down to Westminster itself, very rarely stepping out of that and looking at the EU or the Brussels side of things and wondering about what the opinions are there. As I say, it's just become a very circular, very insular argument that continuing, and I think that is going to continue right up until we find out who exactly that new Tory leader is.
Anyway, let's leave that one slightly to one side and deal with a little bit of Boris news. What's this about a legal problem?
Yes, well, there has been an ongoing case here, and it relates to that big red bus with we send the EU £350 million a week. Let's fund the NHS instead. You'll all remember, of course, that that was on the side of the Vote Leave bus, which brought campaigners right around the country, people like Boris regularly seen stepping off at Cornish pasty in hand or whatever it may have been at the time. Now, this week, it has been decided that Boris Johnson is actually going to have to appear in court over claims relating to that £350 million on the side of a bus. Now, this is a private prosecution which was launched by campaigner Marcus Ball. He's been crowdfunding. He's got almost over £200,000 at this stage to fund the case. And essentially what he's saying is that Boris Johnson and the Vote Leave campaign lied about this, and that this comes down to misconduct in a public office. This week, the judge in the case decided that actually Boris Johnson will have to appear at a preliminary court hearing at Westminster Magistrates Court to answer some of the accusations that Marcus Ball's case is putting forward. And, of course, we can expect that Mr. Johnson unhappy about the timing of this, because well, we don't have an exact date for the court appearance as of yet. It could be that it happens while he is in the middle of running for this Tory leadership campaign. It could very well be that it happens, were he to win the campaign, it could happen in the early weeks of his prime ministerial tenure. So from his point of view, the timing really isn't great. Obviously, he's saying this is politically motivated. It's a stunt by people who just want to stop Brexit. But certainly that sight of Boris Johnson walking into Westminster Magistrates Court to answer claims of lying, and you can be guaranteed the absolutely hundreds of news crews that will be around him. Probably the kind of publicity that even Boris Johnson wouldn't want.
I feel an adjournment application coming on there. Tony, let's speak back to Brussels. How is Europe viewing all of this carry-on in London, or the latest chapter in the carry-on in London?
Yeah, I mean, they're watching it fairly closely, but they're sort of assiduously trying not to get involved, although, of course, when we had the EU leaders' informal dinner this week in Brussels on Tuesday, prime ministers couldn't resist being asked by journalists what they thought about some of the candidates and some of the claims about a no-deal Brexit and reopening the withdrawal agreement. And as Fiona said, the message was fairly explicit. It's not going to happen. The Jean-Claude Juncker, the outgoing Commission president, saying it's crystal clear the withdrawal agreement is closed. Xavier Bettel, the Luxembourg prime minister, saying the same thing. Leo Varadkar, pretty much repeating that, and also making the point that two out of the three MEPs elected in Northern Ireland were now pro-Remain and pro-backstop, and kind of put that in your pipe and smoke it was the message to what he called the British people and the British government. So a fairly blunt riposte from Brussels. Now, I've been speaking to a number of diplomats from different countries about what's going on, and they largely say the same thing, although they would say, well, let's see who's elected and let's see what they say. But while there is room for manoeuvre, and they've said this over and over again, there's room to reopen the political declaration on the future relationship with Brussels. The backstop is closed. One diplomat I spoke to said, look, we'd have to listen to what they say, but like the margin for doing anything on the withdrawal agreement itself is really, really small. The first rule of this process is that nothing could be done that would upset the Irish government. So obviously we'll have to wait and see who gets elected. I've also been speaking to some people about who they would kind of prefer as Tory leader and new prime minister. And interestingly enough, the view seems to be that Boris Johnson might be a slightly better person to have than Dominic Raab, who seems to be in second place behind Boris Johnson at the moment. I think mainly because Johnson is somewhat unpredictable and perhaps malleable, if that's the right word. He was, vacillating between Remain and Leave in the final weeks of the campaign. And there is this paradoxical thing where, he might win the soul of the Tory party and then be the actual person to make the hard compromise, the Nixon in China kind of idea. Also, Dominic Raab is seen as a more dangerous, more difficult kind of prime minister to deal with, because there is a feeling in Brussels that he really does fully believe now in no deal. And if he came as a kind of a gunslinger and with a very kind of hard line message, it might be more difficult for the EU to deal with, because, of course, nobody wants no deal, but nobody wants to reopen the withdrawal agreement. Now, he has been involved in a bit of a skirmish today. In fact, today being Thursday, he gave an interview to The Spectator where he said that when he was Brexit Secretary in the first part of this year and late last year, he was on the verge of actually getting a deal. Now, he put this down to a dinner that he had with Simon Coveney, the Taoiseach and Irish Foreign Minister, in the Irish Embassy in the early first, I think it was the first week or maybe second week of January. Now, he met Coveney and claims now that he had proposed to Coveney that there would be a 3-month kind of time limit to the backstop, and at that point, the UK could insist on a review clause and then could you know, have the final say as to whether or not, as a result of this review clause, the backstop continued. Now, he's saying that Simon Coveney seemed to take that on board, and then that he would talk to Leo Varadkar about it. And then he claimed in this interview with The Spectator that David Lidington, who was Theresa May's de facto deputy and who had opened this kind of back channel with Simon Coveney over about a period of about a year, and who gets on very well with Simon Coveney, that he actually nixed this idea. Now, I remember this coming up at the time and speaking to people around Simon Coveney who were absolutely vehement in their denials that anything like this had been agreed by Simon Coveney at that dinner. Now, the dinner wasn't made public at the time. Nobody knew it was happening, but it was an interesting development. Simon Coveney was in London on his way to meet his counterpart in Paris, and they had this dinner. And yes, Dominic Raab made this suggestion about a three-month time limit to the backstop, and according to Coveney's associates and people close to Simon Coveney, he simply said it was not a runner. It just wouldn't fly. And then he briefed the Taoiseach on this manoeuvre by Dominic Raab, and you know, there was no question of this ever being entertained by the Irish government. But the government then felt that when Dominic Raab made this suggestion a week later, this was an example of the British government trying to drive a wedge between Coveney and Varadkar, saying that Coveney was the moderate one and Leo Varadkar was the hardliner who had done all these, you know, very hardline things like, you know, end the technical explorations last year, et cetera, and, you know, took a much more militant approach on the backstop. He is now using this as a way to get some traction in the leadership challenge.
Just to clarify, though, is Dominic Raab saying in this interview that it was David Lidington who put the kibosh on this manoeuvre, or Leo Varadkar?
Yes. Well, he was saying that it was David Lidington who actually, made sure that this was not a runner, because David Lidington had this very close, you know, developing rapport with Simon Coveney over the past year. They've had this kind of back channel. Now he has said in public already that, you know, Ireland was in favour of this when it came to Simon Coveney, or was sort of, you know, willing to look into it, but that Leo Varadkar had, you know, had put the kibosh on it. But now he's effectively
accused the Taoiseach of being behind a leak of information previously, which he said had undermined efforts that might have led to a happy outcome from his point of view. So is he now switching his story, or do we have two versions out there? One in which Dominic Raab says it was Leo Varadkar's fault, and another one where he's now saying, well, no, it was David Lidington's fault. Or are there two different sets of leaks and two different sets of negotiations being undermined, allegedly?
Well, I think certainly at the time, Leo Varadkar came out publicly shortly after the dinner to say that there was no question of any time limit to the backstop. And I think at the time, Dominic Raab, you know, interpreted this as Leo being bad cop and Simon Coveney being good cop. But now this seems to be a slightly different twist, in that he's saying David Lidington was the person who blocked this idea. Now maybe he's saying that he blocked it in cabinet, having been told by Simon Coveney and their contacts that this was not going to happen. It's just not clear.
I think it's a general expansion of the blame game, you could say, really. And I think it's quite interesting that something like this is essentially being reheated, having been dismissed, as Tony says, already dismissed absolutely and vehemently out of hand by the Irish side at the time when this first came to light, now being sort of reheated, slight twist on it, and being put out there essentially to say, here I was, I almost got a deal done, and if I was leader, I could get it over the line again. And I mean, it's really interesting that these kind of things are coming back out again. No particularly new lines, nothing fresh, but as I say, reheating something that's been out there and already been dismissed, and definitely amongst Tory, moderate Tory MPs. The whole Anyone But Boris campaign, which has been underway since Theresa May's departure has kind of morphed a bit. It remains anyone but Boris, but it's morphed into far more anyone but Rab. I think there is a real, amongst moderate Tories, there is a real concern about Dominic Raab taking over. So I think we'll see a lot.
Yeah, and I think as well, Fiona, that the reason he's bringing this up is because if they're going to try and, you know, retarget the backstop, they will most likely bring in this time limit idea again, because they think that's the kind of softest end of the backstop that they can try and pick away at. And if Dominic Raab can sow the notion out there that, you know, he came close and that the Irish government were a little bit kind of, you know, considering it and then not considering it, then that might be something that he will try and reopen. There was an interesting intervention, I think, as well this week by Jeremy Hunt, who suggested that, first of all, a no-deal Brexit would mean the annihilation of the Tory party, because it would bring about a general election. But he also said that if he was Prime Minister, he would bring the DUP and the ERG into the negotiating room with the EU, which I found somewhat colourful idea. I don't know what you thought of that, Fiona.
Yes, I thought that was certainly an interesting departure, all right, and not one which a lot of people in Westminster were convinced would make negotiations any easier or make them run any more smoothly. As you say, an interesting intervention from him, though, and one which ultimately seems to have done him quite a bit of damage, because he was, you know, using the terminology saying it would be political suicide for a no-deal Brexit, that it would spell the end of the Tory party, would see them out of government. And that followed on from really interesting comments at the weekend from Philip Hammond, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who certainly did not deny that he might very well be prepared to vote against the government in a confidence motion if it meant stopping a no-deal Brexit. Because, of course, you know, there's still an awful lot of discussion about how exactly a no-deal Brexit could be stopped by Parliament, if it could be stopped at all. But one of the possibilities would be that if you get somebody who supports the idea of a no-deal Brexit, that if the Labour Party brought a motion of no confidence in the government, at the moment, of course, if they did that, they don't have the numbers to get it over the line. But if you had enough Tories, enough moderate Tories, enough Remain Tories who decided, we just absolutely don't want a no-deal Brexit, we would be prepared to vote with Labour and against the government to bring down the government to stop that happening, that they might do it. And I mean, Philip Hammond, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, saying, you know, certainly, as I say, not denying that that is something he would consider. It just underlines what incredible times we live in politically.
Yeah, and of course, the mechanism to stop a no-deal Brexit in Parliament, formally, that mechanism has fallen away. They don't have that amendment, do they, to that the House of Commons says it's illegal to have a no-deal Brexit. So, in a sense, the only way that you could stop a no-deal Brexit would be to bring down the government.
Now, also, I suppose, good news, at the moment, that would be the mechanism that everybody is looking at, because it's the most straightforward way, if you like. But good news, I suppose, for people who don't support the idea of no deal, with the news as well from John Bercow, the Speaker of the House of Commons, who had been, it had been anticipated that he might step down this summer. He says he's going nowhere now. Those on the Remain side, of course, believe that might very well help them. Those on the Leave side certainly believe that that might help them, because they have been very angry at some of the decisions that he's made in recent months, because Commons procedure and parliamentary rules have been picked over in a way that probably hasn't happened in decades, and he's had to do some contortions of what those rules might mean as the process has been pushed to its very limits. So a sense from Leavers that if Bercow remains in place, that certainly they will have a tougher time, and that those on the Remain side who might want to try and get through amendments and move legislation that would stop no deal might have an easier time of it.
Well, it's good to know that at least one of the big jobs in this Brexit process has been nailed down effectively. Well, two, I guess, if you include Sabine Vaillant. But what about the other big jobs in the European Union? Because we've been hearing from the various runners and riders, in a rather plaintive way, it has to be said, suggesting that because there's going to be a new European Commission president, then that might change entirely the dynamic of the EU's negotiating approach to Brexit, forgetting, of course, that Article 50 specifies it's the European Council that's in charge here, not the European Commission. Tony, how is this being viewed in Brussels? And what about those big jobs? Any sign of any of these big vacancies being filled? They're not due to be filled, really, until the autumn, apart from Commission President, which is the most urgent of them, isn't it?
Yeah, so we can start on the filling the jobs first, and then I can talk about what impact that's going to have on Brexit. So, yeah, I mean, this week has been dominated by, obviously, the European election results. The elections took place over 3 days, 4 days, actually, Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday last week. And they've been counting the votes. And, you know, as we know, the first big appointment is the president of the European Commission, and that usually reflects the political persuasion of the biggest political group in the European Parliament. So whatever group gets the most seats tends to get to appoint the European Commission president. Now, we've had, obviously, Jean-Claude Juncker, who's from the centre-right European People's Party. Before him, we had José Manuel Barroso, also European People's Party. But, of course, with Juncker, they had this new idea of the lead candidate, or what we call the Spitzenkandidat process, whereby each group will nominate their candidate before the elections take place, so that they can convey this idea that when citizens around Europe get to vote, if they vote for a particular political grouping or party that fits into a political grouping in the European Parliament, then by extension they are kind of voting for the Commission President, because we've had this ongoing debate about the democratic deficit and nobody gets to vote the Commission and so on. So the Spitzenkandidat idea was supposed to give people the kind of ownership of the person who gets appointed. Now, as you know, Sean, from experience, this is a tricky constitutional thing, because the treaties say that the European Council, in other words, the heads of government, really get to say who gets to be Commission President, but they have to take account of the election results, and the European Parliament obviously has to approve whatever candidate is nominated by the Council. So because the election results turned out to be not so good for the European People's Party or the Socialists, who normally get second place, they both lost quite a lot of seats, about 40 seats each. It just means that process has kind of got murkier, because nobody really has a kind of wholehearted mandate from the people to say, right, this guy or this woman has to be the Commission President. And the other complicating factor is that Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has been vociferous in his opposition both to the Spitzenkandidat process and pretty much to the lead candidate from the centre-right, who's Manfred Weber, the Bavarian MEP, who hasn't held ministerial office or been prime minister. So he's out against both. So he's going to be throwing his weight around. And rather than get into a very tempestuous discussion about names on Tuesday night when leaders came here to Brussels to take the first steps in this process, they've talked more about process. So the way they've kind of fixed this is that they've said, okay, we can see that no group in the European Parliament has an overwhelming majority, so therefore none of their candidates will necessarily command the overall support of the European Parliament when that is needed. So they've taken a number of different EU leaders from the different persuasions to say, okay, you guys go off and talk to the parliamentary groups and see if you can work out a kind of a works program for the Parliament, like what kind of legislation do they want to get from the Commission in the next 5 years, and then they can work out who might get the job. Now, first of all, it's a bit of a public clash between Macron and Merkel, because Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, is under some pressure within her own party, which did quite badly in the elections, to have her man in the Berlaymont as Commission President, Manfred Weber. But, of course, Emmanuel Macron is saying not a chance. So this is could be quite a testy kind of start to the new cycle. But what they've done is they've gone off to say, right, we'll try and work out content and then try and figure out names. And the names, apart from Weber, of course, we have Frans Timmermans, who's the socialist candidate. We have Margrethe Vestager, who is in the liberal group. And of course, that is now the group that Emmanuel Macron has aligned himself to. So she's come back in the frame a bit. We've had Michel Barnier, who, of course, we've talked about before. He's also EPP, but he hasn't formally been a candidate. But, of course, he's French, and that might satisfy Emmanuel Macron.
And his son stood for Macron's party in elections in France recently as well. So
that's right, yeah. So there is that odd sort of family connection as well. But you hear other names like Christine Lagarde, the current head of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, who's Bulgarian. She's a former commissioner, very liked, very able. She's currently head of the World Bank. So these are the kind of people that you're getting talked about. Now, I remember listening to Tom Tugendhat, who is a Tory head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in Westminster, on the radio saying, well, you know, in the autumn, we'll have a new Tory prime minister. There's going to be a new commission, a new council, a new parliament, a new council president, a new European Parliament. You know, anything's possible with the withdrawal agreement. But you would have to say that, especially with Sabine Vaillant still in the machinery, and a potential Michel Barnier as Commission President, I think it's somewhat wishful thinking that there's going to be a kind of a clean sweep of the institutions, and that they'll come back with a more a softer approach to Brexit, maybe a more concessionary approach to what the UK is looking for. Because, as you say, Sean, ultimately the British government is negotiating with the European Council on this, and Michel Barnier was not a commissioner. He was the envoy of EU leaders, and he has taken his mandate strictly from EU leaders and the member states. So I really can't see that particular pattern changing.
Mm-hmm. So these elections, the European Parliament elections, have certainly had all kinds of political consequences, not just in Brussels, in the institutions there, but also in member states, particularly thinking of Greece, which was heading for elections anyway, but a snap election called in the immediate wake of those European Parliament elections. Speculation about a general election in Italy as well, because of the shifting patterns of support that have been apparent. Talk perhaps of an early election here in Ireland as well. In amongst all of this, of course, in the lead into this European election, there'd been an awful lot of noise about populist parties, particularly on the right of the political spectrum, about to make a huge breakthrough in the European elections. Didn't seem to work out that way, did it, Tony?
No, Sean, I think you're right. I mean, all the talk in the run-up to the elections was about a populist surge that could result in Eurosceptic, populist, far-right nationalist parties taking up to one-third of the seats in the European Parliament. Now, as things have turned out, they've got roughly the same as they had in 2014, although Matteo Salvini, who is the leader of the Lega party in Italy, it used to be the Northern League, now it's just called Lega. But it's a fairly, you know, hardline anti-immigrant party, populist. He did very well in the elections. He got about 35%, and he has been trying to forge this new alliance that would be an umbrella group for all of the disaffected, insurgent parties within the European sphere, and make them a much more cohesive force in the European Parliament. Because, of course, in the last cycle, they did very well in 2014, but they were just not really that effective as a bloc in the Parliament, because they tended to be scattered across different groups. But he's now been trying to bring them into this European alliance of peoples and nations, and he's had some success with Marine Le Pen and so on. There has been talk that he's almost got Nigel Farage's Brexit Party in there as well. Now, they've been in a different group in the Parliament. I think Nigel Farage has been reluctant when he was with UKIP. They were reluctant to get into bed with the far right in France. But they may well decide to go in with Salvini's group to give it more heft. But elsewhere, as you say, the far right, the Eurosceptics, did not do quite so well. Like in Denmark, they had a terrible time. They've only come back with one MEP. In Germany, the Alternative for Deutschland was around 10%, you know, better than they did in 2014, but worse than they did in the recent German election. The true Finns, or now the Finns, did not do very well. Having said that, of course, we have Marine Le Pen's national rally in France. They beat Emmanuel Macron. They got about 24% of the vote. And in Poland, of course, we had the Law and Justice Party getting 52%, which was extraordinary in the end. And then in Hungary, we have Viktor Orban, who is the kind of bête noir of the European mainstream. He is still officially in with the centre-right group. They got 46%, I think, of the vote. Actually,
Geert Wilders,
I'm making a mistake.
In the Netherlands also got quite a hammering in the election. I think they lost all of their seats.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
And then the Freedom Party in Austria caught in that eve of election sting involving a apparently fake.
Yeah, they didn't do quite so well. Although I think they still ended up with a fairly respectable 17%. I should correct those figures, actually. I think it was Viktor Orban's party got about 52% and the Law and Justice Party in Poland got about 46%. But still, you know, these are very, you know, resounding endorsements of a, you know, fairly Eurosceptic anti-immigrant sentiment, especially in Eastern Europe. But the problem again is that Viktor Orban, even though he's been suspended, is still officially in with the European People's Party. So the speculation is now that he might actually decamp over to Matteo Salvini's side. So ultimately, you know, what damage can these groups do? Can they really frustrate the European project? It really depends on the subject matter. You know, they could be, you know, when it comes to the budget negotiations with the Parliament, they could, you know, make life very difficult by trying to slow the thing down, try and cut back the budget. Although, for example, you know, the Italians would like more money spent by the EU on the EU's external borders. You have this differential on Russia. You know, Matteo Salvini, the Lega, very close to Vladimir Putin and United Russia. But of course, when you move further east, the Polish Law and Justice Party want nothing to do with Russia. And the same in some of the Baltic far-right or Eurosceptic parties. So it's not entirely clear how much damage they could do, but in certain key areas they could do quite a bit of damage.
Of course, we should talk as well about the Greens. These parties, though, Tony, we could just look at the one of the interesting linkages here, particularly between Salvini and Le Pen and Geert Wilders and Nigel Farage. One name that keeps cropping up is Steve Bannon, President Trump's former campaign director, who has been behind an organization called The Movement, which is trying to coordinate a lot of these Eurosceptic groups within Europe. And I think you've met Steve Bannon's man in Brussels and had a chat with him about this master plan, this grand strategy that they have to organise, well, a movement against the European Union.
Yes, so Steve Bannon has very quickly set his sights on Europe. He, of course, masterminded Donald Trump's election victory, then he fell out of favour, but he has been on manoeuvres trying to graft on the same recipe that succeeded in America in Europe. And so he's been talking to Eurosceptic parties, anti-immigrant parties, and they've all been you know, very keen to talk to him. And so I've been talking to a man called Michael Modrikamen, who is a Belgian lawyer and a candidate for a small right-wing party in Belgium called the Popular Party. And he actually did some work in America for Donald Trump. And then he became friends with Nigel Farage. And through the Farage link, he met Steve Bannon. And so he is now heading this thing called The Movement, which, as you can hear in the interview, he describes it as a club. But he is now, I suppose, Steve Bannon's man in Europe, trying to, you know, to realise Bannon's dream of effectively dismantling the EU from within. Although, as we can hear in the interview, he's a little bit nuanced on that. But let's hear what he says now. This is Michael Modrikamen, who's a Belgian lawyer running The Movement.
I was supporting Trump from the beginning, made videos that were some success, 3 million views in the US. After Trump's election, I sent a memo to transition team saying, okay, we got the Brexit, we got your election, Now, this populist uprising has to become global. We have to liaise all together. Nothing happened at that time until Nigel Farage, which is a friend, called me. It was June last year, June 2018, saying, okay, since Bannon went already two times in Europe, I mentioned the movement that you had planned, he's interested, you should meet. So we lunched together in London in July. And it was a match, I mean, in terms of idea and personality. We want to liaise between the populists. That's the main objective. We had the idea also to bring some services to them, but we had to skip the idea for various reasons, the main reason being legal reason. It was forbidden in many countries to come with contribution in financial or in kind. So we didn't do that. So basically today it's liaison between person. It's advancing our ideas.
Now, Steve Bannon was the mastermind, if you like, of Donald Trump's successful presidential campaign. He's seen as embodying the populist, anti-immigrant, far-right, insurgent narrative. Where does that fit in Europe of the 21st century?
Well, we believe that first, populist means representing the ordinary guy. Trump is representing the ordinary American, okay, from the Rust Belt, from the Deep West. Salvini is representing the ordinary Italian. Farage, with the Brexit, is representing the ordinary British guy. The idea is that basically populism fits everywhere. I mean, it's also fitting for Bolsonaro in Brazil. It's fitting for the Japan ruling party. I think that the populist uprising fits everywhere because the struggle is everywhere. It's a big struggle going on today for what should be, what kind of democracy, in what kind of structure we are living. You have basically the globalist approach that say, okay, we are all just interchangeable human beings. You can put people from everywhere, put them together, it will work. We believe as sovereignists that in order to have a vibrant democracy and to have a say on your future, you need people that are sharing values. That means that you need states, you need borders, and so on. This doesn't mean that people coming from outside cannot become citizens, of course. But you have first to integrate into this value system. And Europe is one of the battlefields, but there has been many these last year, and there will be many the next years.
But it's a battlefield for what reason? What are the issues that you see are the driving populist issues in Europe?
Everybody accept the idea that the EU today doesn't work, doesn't function. It's dysfunctional.
Well, everybody meaning who? Exactly?
No, I mean from the populists, even the pro-European accept the idea that the Europe as it stands today is dysfunctional.
In what way?
It's not democratic.
These are democratic governments. They're elected. They appoint commissioners. They have ministers. They have MEPs.
The engine of the European system is the Commission, where these people basically are chosen, are not elected, and they are not accountable. I cannot vote on Juncker or on Mogherini and so on. They have been appointed without my consent.
Well, they're appointed by the heads of government, and you have a Spitzenkandidat process, which gives people the chance to say, I'll vote for this person because they're in this political party.
Okay, but ultimately, it won't be for the citizen to choose them, okay? As sovereignists, we say we have to go back to more competence, more freedom for the national states.
What is your and what is the movement's ultimate objective? Is it for the European Union to fall apart?
The aim of the movement is not European. It's worldwide. I mean, we have people from South America, from Asia, from America, from Europe, of course, from Israel, from the Arab states. We don't only focus on Europe. But if you ask me about Europe, some would like to have it totally disappear. Nigel and Farage has been the leader of the Brexit movement and want to get rid of the EU. We, as European, I mean, I'm in Belgium at the heart of Europe. I don't say that a European structure has to disappear.
Is that because Brexit has been so problematic? There's been such disarray in the... Has that changed opinions across the movement?
I think it has been problematic because the elites, political elites, didn't deliver the vote.
You mean the House of Commons?
The House of Commons and those who
elected
opposed,
representatives?
Didn't deliver the choice of the citizens of the UK. That's the main problem. So, and we'll see. I hope that will be delivered. And I personally think it will be a good result for the UK. Ultimately,
will it be a hard Brexit, do you think? Like a no deal Brexit?
Personally, taking into consideration all the discussion that took place, I would push for a hard Brexit, and I think ultimately we'll end there. But in the meantime, you know, you see the reaction from the citizen towards the political class. I mean, Farage was forced to rebuild the party, and in 3 weeks it is leading, or in a month it's now leading in the polls with expectations equaling both the Conservative and the Labour's together. It is obvious that a large majority of citizens wants a restriction on migration, particularly from non-EU countries. It's overwhelming. And if you look at the position of the commissioners, they basically say we need migration, we have to keep the borders open.
Well, they've said that they have an obligation under international law to accept refugees who are fleeing war. What they wanted to do was to make sure that the refugees that did come in, whether they were genuine refugees or economic migrants, that they would be shared throughout the EU rather than have Italy and Greece take the huge burden of dealing with that issue.
There's a lot of confusion, migrants, refugees and so on. We have some obligation vis-a-vis the refugees. We don't have that much obligation vis-a-vis the migrants. The problem also is that everybody comes pretending to be refugee.
Sure, yeah, and the Commission knows that. And of course, you can only send people back to countries where you have an agreement. So it's not, things are complex. It's not that simple.
We didn't say that it wasn't complex, of course. But the populist and we pushed for a long time for the Australian model, okay? We don't let anybody get in. I mean, this has to be clear, by boats or by crossing the borders. And if you do that, you lose in any case, all right. But we need to establish hotspots, you know, and they're clear the people that would be allowed to get in. And this would dissuade the migrants to try to cross the Mediterranean and will avoid a lot of casualties.
And the EU have proposed that, and the Commission has worked on these disembarkation centres in North Africa. All of these things the EU is looking at.
Finally, wasn't enforced. And the problem also is that, as you know, certainly, is that the obligation to accept the migrants comes from a decision from the Court of Justice for Human Rights that they decided was in 2013, I think.
European Court of Human Rights?
Yeah.
Not an EU institution.
No, but they submitted to this decision finally, ultimately, altogether, saying, okay, we have to let the migrants first get in. We cannot push back the boats and so on. And I think it's a big mistake. And it's also part of the problem.
Well, that's against international law. You can't, refoulement is against international. You can't push boats back into the sea.
No. This was a totally new interpretation. Okay, we have the court, human rights, and you have the Convention of Human Rights, which in itself, of course, is a good instrument. But we have seen through the years, we have seen a kind of activism, you know, from some of the judges to push it more and more. I mean, far from the initial design from those who wrote this agreement. They are not judges that we would usually see judges. I mean, people that went through a full system, you know, a barrister and then appointed and then, you know, climbed a ladder. It's basically professor of human rights and so on with very often little experience.
Well, they're appointed by members of the Council of Europe. They're appointed by their governments.
There is no doubt about this. I'm just talking about the background and the kind of people that are sent there.
Because the problem facing the Eurosceptic corpus, if you like, in Europe, is that they are often on different pages when it comes to issues like Russia, issues like protectionism, migration, all of those things. So how effective do you think a new Eurosceptic bloc could be in the European Parliament?
Okay, we focus on a few tenets. I mean, basically, as I told you, sovereignty, borders, fight against radical Islam, limit of migration. On this, we believe that the populist can agree. If we agree, for example, that the EU competences should be reduced and that more power also should be given back to the state. On this we can all agree. From that point, we will all conduct the policies we will choose and that our electors, who they've mandated to do.
Mind you, it's built into the EU's treaties, that the concept of subsidiarity, so that where powers should go back to the nation state, that they do, and that the EU is generally committed to policies that have a cross-border nature, that deal with issues that are not simply solvable by member states on their own, like climate change, issues around globalization, trade. What's the problem with that?
First of all, that's a principle. Now, if you look at the realities, it is today accepted that approximately 80% of national legislation derives from the EU. If you call this subsidiarity, I mean, in fact, I think it's the opposite.
So well, the 80%, that's a statistic that was attributed to the House of Lords, but in fact, when they looked into that, it was only about 12 or 13%.
Yeah, this is, I wouldn't agree with this. We have made also these studies, and there is a consensus that a very important portion comes from EU influence and curtailing totally our national legislation. So there is a nice principle, but if you look at the numbers of directives and regulation, ultimately, it is organizing all the life of the national European states. Citizen needs a say on their future. And while it...
I mean, they have a say through who they elect. The ministers that are sent to Brussels, they're elected.
Yeah, but
MEPs are elected.
Yeah, but ultimately, if you look how it works, the process is diluted. And many, you know, you would have national governments saying ultimately, this was decided at the EU level through a complex mechanism made of a lot of countries intervening, made of lobbying, made of the European Parliament. And this is very...
That's how it's... I mean, it'll not work any other way unless you have a consensus and structures and rules and different countries having different weight because of their population sizes.
I agree that at the EU, this is the way it's functioning. But this doesn't mean that it is democratic. This doesn't mean that it's not alienated or alienating from the ordinary citizens.
You talk about democracy and values. What part of democracy and values have to do with the Russian efforts to undermine elections, to sow divisiveness in different demographic groups in America? And clearly that potential is there in Europe as well.
Listen, I wouldn't deny that the Russian try to interfere and they will come. But on which I totally disagree with the comments of some mainstream media or the elites, is that the Russians have nothing to do with the victory of Trump or the Brexit or whatever.
Well, there have been investigations in the United States which would completely contradict that. Clear efforts by the Russians to undermine and create divisive narratives within groups in America.
They can do all this. The only thing I want to tell you is that the British didn't vote for the Brexit because of the Russian. They voted for the Brexit because they felt that the EU policies were betraying the interests of the UK people, the Englishmen.
You've spoken about your preference, if necessary, for a hard Brexit or a no-deal exit. What concern would you extend to Ireland and the Irish peace process, which would be very badly damaged, according to most people, by a hard Brexit or a no-deal Brexit?
I think ultimately we'll find ways to avoid, you know, hard borders. The way I see it from the outside, what you want to avoid, of course, is division. I mean, physical borders between the people. What the EU and the customs system doesn't want is, you know, products flooding, you know, without control.
Yeah, and I'm sure Belgian and French farmers wouldn't want that either.
Yeah, and I've been told that certainly for a lot of products, there are no today, we are in the 21st century, many ways to find a practical solution to this problem.
So that's the movement in Europe. Let's look ahead, though, to the immediate short term, the week ahead. Fiona, what's happening in your watch in London?
Oh, here will be all Trump, Trump, and more Trump. He arrives on Monday morning for his three-day state visit, which is the first official state visit, Sean. We know he has, of course, been here before, but the state visit is the one with all the bells and whistles. There will be a lot of time spent with the royal family, for which he is bringing also his entire family, all of his children, and their partners are accompanying him and his wife on this trip. So lots of Trump next week, Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, and where Donald Trump goes, most likely protests will follow. So you can expect plenty of people out on the streets of London as well, protesting at the visit. And then, of course, by the end of the week, that will be one of the last official engagements for Theresa May, because by the end of the week on Friday the 7th, she officially steps down. So she is leaving. That will be her last hurrah, if you like, that visit of Donald Trump. So a busy week ahead, but at least Theresa May knows that from next weekend she won't face that usual spectre outside her church on a Sunday morning of photographers waiting and throwing questions to her about Brexit.
And Tony, anything happening in Brussels next week?
Well, the talks between the council and the parliament over how they're going to figure out these top jobs over the next few weeks. Of course, that process has to end with the European Council in 3 weeks' time. They're hoping to get the Commission and then the European Council President job filled, and also the ECB, which we never mentioned. That's kind of a separate track. And of course, the European Parliament will have to get their new job. So that work will continue. But all eyes will be on the Normandy coast, because one of the reasons Donald Trump is swinging by London is that he's on his way to Normandy to commemorate the 75th, I think, anniversary of the D-Day landings. Is it 75th?
It is indeed 75th, yes.
Yes, there we go. It's the 75th, yeah. Didn't want to be 10 years out. a lot of world leaders will be gathering there. And so I'll be there, and we will be bringing Brexit Republic from Normandy next week. That'll be a change of scenery. But of course, given that Nigel Farage always has lamented the fact that he didn't take part in D-Day, there is perhaps an appropriate reason for bringing you Brexit Republic from the Normandy beaches next week. So until then, it's goodbye from me, Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And it's goodbye from me, Fiona Mitchell, RTE's London correspondent in London.
And it's goodbye from me, Sean Whelan, the economics correspondent here in Dublin. Brexit and Trump together in the same place. Who'd have thunk it? See you again soon, folks.